Hi, my name is Adina Schmidman, founding director of the OU Women's Initiative. Thank you for being a part of our Torah programming. Join me this Wednesday, May 25th and Thursday, May 26th in appreciating, supporting, and expanding the Torah programs offered by the OU Women's Initiative. Programs that you enjoy, like Torah Imecha Nachyomi, Torah Imecha Parsha, Rosh Chodesh Lunch and Learn, Counting Towards Sinai, Ideas and Inspiration, the Max and Yeti Mandir Aleihem HaShalom Elite Virtual Beit Midrash, and more. You can contribute early and jumpstart our fundraising campaign by going today to ou.org/women22. Join me in transforming women's Torah learning. And now for today's presentation.
Welcome to Torah Imecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rachel Vesser, and today we'll be studying the last parak of Melachim Aleph, Parak Kafet, Chapter 22. We left off the last parak with Achav doing tshuva after the murder of Nabot. Parak Kafet begins by telling us that it's been 3 years since the war with Aram has happened, and we're introduced now to a new character, King Yehoshaphat of Yehuda. Yehoshaphat is the son of Asa, who has since died, and Yehoshaphat is similar to his father in that they both follow Hashem and both have stable monarchies. They differ, however, in their relationship with Malchut Yisrael, the kingdom of Yisrael. While Asa had fought bitterly with Baasha, then the king, we meet Yehoshaphat, who's in Malchut Yisrael. He had traveled there to visit Achav, with whom he had made an alliance. In Divrei HaYamim, we learn that the two kings not only had an alliance, but had married into each other's families, the strongest level of partnership possible, with Achav's daughter, Ataliah, married to Yehoshaphat's son. Before we enter into the narrative of this parak, let's take a moment to examine this alliance between the two kings. This is actually what we've been waiting for. Since the time of Yeravam and Rechavam, the two countries, the 10 tribes and the 2 tribes, have been at war. It's almost like they forgot that they are one nation with a shared history and a shared destiny. During the test on Har Carmel, we saw Eliel use 12 stones and 12 buckets of water as a symbol of the unification of the 12 tribes. And now we see that Achav was actually able to actualize this idea and had allied with Malchut Yehudah. The two countries are no longer at war. It's a wonderful sight. On the other hand, the reason Eliel thought that the 10 tribes should and could be united because he was in the process of convincing Achav to follow Hashem. The tribes would be united in politics, but also in religion. They would both follow Hashem together. That's what Eliel was trying to teach when he was on Har Carmel. In this parak, Achav has not given up his idolatrous ways. It's complicating to wonder if Yehoshaphat was correct in making this type of alliance with Yisrael, considering that Yisrael is still a nation of idol worshippers, and Malchut Yehudah, Yehoshaphat's country, actually follows Hashem. Perhaps Yehoshaphat, like Ovadia, if you remember him, he was the one who worked for Achav that we met when they were looking for some vegetation to feed their animals during the drought. Perhaps he also thought that the best way to influence Achav was to join him, unlike Eliyahu, and have a dream of a somewhat unified country, exactly as they should be, separate politically, but joined religiously, if only Yehoshaphat could influence him to do good. At the end of As we approach the end of Melachim Aleph, this dream of a unified country has a chance of being realized. On the other hand, Achav is not there yet, and there's a risk that instead of influencing Achav, Achav will influence Yehoshaphat. The consequence of this decision will play out in Melachim Bet and impact the story of both kingdoms. For now, we're cautiously optimistic at the sight of the two kingdoms not fighting each other, but helping each other. Achav turns to Yehoshaphat, his ally, and his mechutan, his daughter's father-in-law, and says to him in Pasuk Dalid, verse 4, Vayomer al Yehoshaphat, Hatelechi ti lamilchama Ramot Gilad, will you come join me in war for the city of Ramot Gilad? Vayomer Yehoshaphat al Melch Yisrael, Yehoshaphat responds, Kamoni kamocha, I am like you, kami kamecha, my nation is your nation, kisusai kisusecha, my horses are like your horses. Ramot Gilad was one of the cities that Ben-Hadad had promised to return to Achav when Achav let him go free at the end of Parak 20. Had Achav killed Ben-Hadad in Parak 20, he wouldn't have had to be dependent on Ben-Hadad fulfilling his promise and returning any cities. Achav could have just gone and taken them as a result of killing the king of Aram. Now we learn that Ben-Hadad had not fulfilled his promise to Achav, no surprise, and had given him nothing in return for Achav letting him go free. Yehoshaphat agrees to help Ahab, and he uses very strong terms of connection. I am like you. My nation is like your nation. My horses is like your horses. Again, we feel these conflicting emotions about this partnership. On the one hand, it's wonderful. On the other hand, Yehoshaphat and Ahab are very different religiously. And we're going to see this religious difference manifest itself in their conversation right away. Ahav, now they're thinking about going to war, and before they go to war, Ahav gathers 400 Nevi'im and asks them, as is typical for a king to ask the prophets before war, Ha'elecha Ramot Gilad, La'milchama, should I go and try to conquer the city of Ramot Gilad? Will we be successful? And they answer, Aleva Hitzlach, V'natan Hashem B'yad HaMelech. Yes, you should go up. You will be successful. Hashem will give it into your hands. And I just want you to realize how complicated this is, because they don't quote Baal here. They quote Hashem. And they say that, yes, Hashem will give you the land. And it does actually seem perhaps that Ahab has changed. Yehoshaphat, however, is suspect of these prophets. He doesn't actually think that they are true. Rashi explains that all these 400 prophets, they all echoed the same words, which is impossible for in prophecy. Each Navi sees an image and then uses his or her own language to express the vision that they see. Hearing people all speak together in the same words is key to understanding that they're not actually Nevi'im of Hashem. Rather, they're people whose job it is to support the policies of the king, and they couch it as if it's a prophecy. This is really going to be explored later in Tanakh when there's an influx of Nevi'ei Sheker right before the Chorban. Yehoshaphat responds, Vayomer Yehoshaphat in Pasuk Zayin, Ha'ein po Navi laHashem od v'nidrasham eito? Is there no real Navi for Hashem that we can actually ask? And realize these are very brave words from Yehoshaphat, as he's directly criticizing his ally, Ahav, to steer him towards a worldview that Ahav doesn't necessarily share. Ahav answers in verse 8, Vayomer Melech Yisrael Yehoshaphat, Od ish echad lidrosh et Hashem eito. Yes, there is one other man that we could perhaps ask, and he is a true Navi of Hashem. V'anis neitiv, but I actually really hate him. Ki lo yitnabe elai tov ki imra, he always gives me bad prophecies. Michayo ben Yimla, his name is Michayo ben Yimla. Vayomer Yehoshaphat, Al Yomar Melech King, don't say such a thing. Don't think of prophecy that way, Ahav. A prophet doesn't speak to you based on his own personal feelings about you. The prophet is just giving you over the word of Hashem. It pays to listen to him. And we remember the confrontation between Ahav and the Navi, who was not named, back in Parak 20. But it's clear that we're talking about the same person, and we understand why Ahav thinks that Michai, who hates him. All he did was let Ben-Hadad go free. And then this Navi came and gave him such a bad prophecy and said, oh, your life will be instead of his, your nation instead of his nation. It also allows us a window into Ahav's mind and his thoughts about prophecy. A prophet in Ahav's mind is there to back up the king. If the prophet stands against the king, like Eliyahu did or Michayu, then it's because the prophet doesn't like him. It's personal. And she remember, Ahav always said to Eliyahu, you're my enemy. You're the Ocher Yisrael. You're Oivi. And he said the same thing to Michayhu. He was so upset when Michayhu gave him a bad prophecy, as if Michayhu did something wrong and that it didn't come from Hashem. In Ahav's view, he believes that the prophet can actually control his prophecy. And therefore, if a prophet gives you a bad one, it's because the prophet doesn't like you. And there were times where we saw that Ahav was maybe able to break through this mindset, once at Har Carmel and the other one at Kerem Navot. But in both times, he reverted afterwards to a different mindset that protects him from criticism of the prophet. Yehoshaphat keeps pushing, though. He doesn't give up. And he says, you know what? Let's speak to Michayu. Let's hear what he has to say. Michayu enters a scene where Ahav and Yehoshaphat are dressed in their royal garments, sitting at the gates of Shomron, clearly preparing for a war. They've already really decided to go, with all these prophets standing before them, prophesying and encouraging them. They're all, again, speaking the same words as each other. Ale Ramot Gilad v'etzlach, go up to Ramot Gilad, you will be successful. V'natan Hashem v'yad hamelech, Hashem has already given it into your hands. One of the main people of the false prophets is named Tzidkiah ben Kenana, and he even goes so far as to make a symbol of his prophecy, iron horns. And he proclaims, Be'ela tinagachet Aram ad kalotam, with these horns you will gore through Aram until you have completely destroyed them. As the messenger is bringing Mikhail to the scene, he warns him that he better give a good prophecy like the other prophets are giving. Mikhail responds that he can only say what Hashem tells him to. He's not in control of the prophecy because actually his prophecy is real. So we see that a lot of people share Ahav's mindset about prophecy and don't want to take criticism as something that comes from Hashem. Mikhail stands before Ahav and he asks him the question. Ahav said, should we fight for Ramot Gilead? Will we be successful? Remember, last time it was Mikhail in Parak 20, who told him he would be successful in war twice, and only after he let Ben-Hadad go free did the prophet criticize him. Mikhail responds, Alei v'tlach, v'natan Hashem b'yad ha-melech, go up and be successful, Hashem has already given it into your hands. Clearly, making fun of the false prophets by quoting them exactly. Ahav gets the sarcasm, and he responds in Pasuk 16, V'yomri lev ha-melech, ad kama panim ani mashbi'acha, asher lo tidaver le'rak emet b'shem Hashem. Come on, Mikhail. Tell me the truth. Didn't I tell you should tell me the truth? Everyone knows that Mikhail is lying here. And now we see Ahav again swinging back and forth between belief in Hashem and wanting to control him. Meaning when Mikhail quotes the false prophet, Ahav doesn't like that either. And this is exactly what Eliyahu had accused him of. Poschim al shtei asipim, and Bnei Yisrael were also poschim al shtei asipim, jumping back and forth between opinions. Sometimes you do believe in Hashem. Sometimes you don't believe in Hashem. You have a very complex relationship with prophecy, with prophets, with criticism. And this is a very negative quality, but actually has a positive element to it also. If you're jumping back and forth between two opinions, then you haven't rejected Hashem. There's still hope for you. And we see here there really is hope for Ahav. Mikhail turns to Ahav and Yehoshaphat and says, you want the truth? Okay, here it is, verse 17. Vayomer ra'iti et kol Yisrael nefotzim al haharim ketzon asher ein lahem ro'eh. I see that Bnei Yisrael are spread out on the mountains like sheep without shepherds. Vayomer Hashem lo adonim la'ela. Their Hashem has declared there is no master to these. Yeshuvu ish lebeito v'shalom. Everyone should go back to their house in peace. The implication is sheep without a shepherd, meaning the nation will not have a king. Ahav will die in this war if he continues with it. Mikhail then continues, and he says, I saw in my prophecy that Hashem turned to all the celestial beings, and he asked them, who will trick Ahav into going to war? Each one comes up with an idea until the ruach, the wind, said, I will be the spirit of lies in the mouth of his prophet. Hashem chose the wind, and that's why, says Mikhail, all of your prophets are lying to you. Don't believe them, Ahav. This war will turn out bad for you. The Nevi'ei Sheker are furious. They've just been accused of being Nevi'ei Sheker, which clearly they are. And Tzidkiah ben Kenana takes out iron horns, and he smacks Mikhail across the face with them. Ahav is furious as well. He tells his servants to take Mikhail to jail and hold him there until he returns alive from the battle, unlike Mikhail's prophecy. But now Ahav is in a bind. He desperately wants to go to war. He's already really started getting his troops together, and it's very hard to turn back once you have momentum in that area. Also, not having gotten back those cities from Aram is a stain on his armor. They were, first of all, already taken from Yisrael by Aram. And now Ben-Hadad isn't returning them after Ahav made the decision to let him go free. And had he not made that decision, he really would have gotten the cities back already. On the other hand, he does believe Mikhail, and he doesn't want to die. There is something inside him that tells him that Mikhail is a true prophet. So Ahav has an idea. Mikhail says that he sees Bnei Israel on the hill like sheep without a shepherd. So Ahav is going to find a loophole. Maybe if he can fulfill the technical meaning of the prophecy, he can save himself. Therefore, he says to Yehoshaphat in Pasuk 30, Vayomer melech Yisrael el Yehoshaphat, Hitchapes ubaba bamilchama va'ata lavash bigdecha. I am going to disguise myself in the war, and you can wear your regular royal clothes. And that is what he does. Meaning, if he doesn't look like a leader, if he dresses just like a regular soldier, then the picture that you see is only regular soldiers without a leader. And that maybe can technically fulfill Michayahu's prophecy of tzon asher ein lahem ro'eh, of sheep with no shepherd, because you won't actually see the leader. Of course, this is ridiculous. Michayahu have said, im shuv tashuv b'shalom lo diber Hashem bi, if you come back alive, then I'm a false prophet, meaning I'm not a false prophet and you're not going to come back alive. It's clear that you can't get around this nevuah with tricks, but this is what Ahav wants to try. What's really difficult to understand is why Yehoshaphat goes along with this plan. It's not clear. Maybe it's because the partnership with Ahav is too important to him. He has this great dream of bringing peace between the 12 tribes, and he doesn't want to mess it up by standing up to Ahav yet again. He's already done it a couple of times. It's also possible that in this way, Yehoshaphat can justify his participation in a war that Hashem is clearly telling them that they will lose, meaning the prophet wasn't speaking to Yehoshaphat. The prophet was speaking to Ahav. If Ahav wants to do it like this, it's up to him. It's not clear, but Yehoshaphat does go along with this plan and go into war with Ahav. Meanwhile, Ben-Hadad, we get a little viewpoint into his camp. And instead of being grateful to Ahav for freeing him, now Ben-Hadad actually has a burning hatred of Ahav. He tells his soldiers in verse 31, Lo tilachamu im katon ve'et gadol ki imet melch Yisrael levado. Don't even go after anybody else, not big, not small. I want you to kill the king of Yisrael. He has a real vendetta against Ahav. And we understand this, actually, that Ahav had emasculated Ben-Hadad by letting him go free, and he had beaten him twice. Instead of gratitude, Ben-Hadad needs to prove his worth as a king. He has a vendetta against Ahav that Ahav doesn't even know about. From Ahav's perspective, Ben-Hadad owes him one. Anyway, the Aramean soldiers go into war on a quest for Ahav, but there being no newspapers or TV, they don't actually know what he looks like. So they're looking for a person who's dressed as a king. And as we know, Ahav is not dressed as a king. He's dressed as a regular soldier. And they see one person in the war who is dressed as a king, and actually it's Yehoshaphat. So they go after him. Yehoshaphat is now under pressure from all these Aramean soldiers that are after him, and he calls out to Hashem, Vayza'ik El Hashem, he davens. And miraculously, they don't kill him because they realize somehow that he's not Ahav. Radak says that they recognize his voice in some way. At the same time as they're after Yehoshaphat and then turning back from him, the Pasuk says, in Pasuk Lama Dalad, verse 32, Ve'ish mashach bakeshet letumo. There's a freak accident. One soldier is just shooting an arrow, meaning it's a big battle scene. By Aket Melch Yisrael, he ends up hitting Ahav. Bein Advakim uBein Hashir Yon. He hits him between the different pieces of the cracks of his armor, between the breastplate and the lower honor. And Ahav now is hit. He's wounded. He's bleeding out. Vayomer l'rechbo, so he says to his wagon driver, Hafoch yadcha, turn around, v'tzeitiani min hamachanek yehechaleti, take me out of the war. I need medical attention. I need to lie down. I'm bleeding. And that's what happens. He takes him out of the war. The chariot driver takes Ahav away. And Bnei Yisrael see that Ahav is hit. And they see he left the war. And the morale sinks and they start to lose. Ahav sees what's happening. And now he has a decision. He can save his own life, but his people are going to get slaughtered. Or he can re-enter the war, give up on his medical treatment, save them, but lose himself. And Ahav does make the decision in Pasuk Lamed Hey, verse 35, Vata'ale ha-milchama b'yom ha-hu, the war is getting worse. And Ahav rejoins the battle. V'ha-melech ha-yama amad b'mirchava nochach haram. He comes back in his chariot and he stands up, and you could just imagine what's happening to his blood. He's been hit by an arrow. His blood is bleeding out and he is dying, but he holds onto that chariot. So the people see him standing and their morale comes back and they start fighting and they make it all the way till nightfall. V'yama ba'erev, and Ahav dies that evening. V'yatzek dam ha-maka el chik ha-rechav, and his blood fills up the chariot. At nightfall, there's a break in the battle, and then they're able to call all of Bnei Yisrael to retreat, and they are saved, but Ahav dies. By this time, the chariot is full of blood. They take it down to the river to wash it, and in Pasuk Lamed Chet, verse 38, Vayishtofet ha-rechav al brechat Shamron, they wash it on the pool of Shamron, Vayiloku ha-klavim et damo, the dogs go and lick up that water, meaning they drank Achav's blood, Vazonot Rachatzu, and that was the place where the prostitutes washed themselves, Kedvar Hashem Asher Diber, just like Hashem spoke. Eliyahu's curse on Achav is fulfilled, but not in the way we had anticipated. Instead of Achav dying in a demeaning fashion, he dies in glory, sacrificing himself for the people. With this act of self-sacrifice, we end Malachim Aleph. We see in this last act, the heroism and the care for the people that Achav possessed the whole time. He never returned to Hashem with a full heart, but he did deep down care for his people. Every time he's away from his Evel, his good side shines through. Every time he goes back to the palace and she enters the scene, he loses his moral compass. It's been a wonderful journey learning together with you. Remember that Malachim Aleph and Bet are really one book. Many of the themes that we've begun to explore will only be fully realized in the second half of the book. Until then, I'd like to comment on one issue. Was this kingship system just destined to fail? It's so hard to read this book. It's depressing. No one seems to do the right thing. Why is this book in our Tanakh? To answer that, we really need to remember why this book was written and by whom. The Navi Yirmiyahu is standing before a Beit HaMikdash after having stood for 410 years and now it's in ruins. He knows that the reasons for the destruction run deep. It's not just the problems of the generation of the Chorban. Sefer Malachim is a rumination on the process leading to destruction. What went right, but more so what went wrong? How did we get here? And most crucially, how can we make sure in our history of the Jewish people that we never do this again? Mesha, the king of Moab, made a monument to his triumphs that we referenced in Parent 16. On it, Mesha describes how wonderful he was in war, allowing for the fact that Kamosha's god was angry at him in the days of Omri and allowed Omri to be successful for some time. But the bulk of the stele proclaims Mesha's greatness, his prowess, the countries he conquered. Many nations write histories of their countries and tell the story with their own interpretation, downplaying their mistakes and playing up their triumphs. Malachim is the opposite. It plays up the mistakes and downplays the triumphs. Was the king's system perfect? No. Did it have a chance to succeed? Yes, if the kings would have followed the instructions of Devarim Yedzayin and limited their power and cared for their people and tried to bring them closer to Hashem. The role of the Navi is highlighted in this book. The king doesn't have to be perfect. He just needs to have the ability to see his own flaws and change. Perhaps this is the enduring lesson of Sefer Malachim, one that we can really take with us into our future. Criticism is always hard to hear, especially if you are in a position of power. But true reflection and humility allow us to be clear-sighted about our own inevitable flaws and help ourselves and our communities advance and come closer to Hashem. Thank you for studying together. Le'ilei Nishmat Frida Bat Moshe Eliyahu. Moshe Eliyahu. Moshe Eliyahu.